Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, obviously this has been a very disturbing week in U.S. history with the killing of an innocent woman in Minneapolis. And I just wanted to point people to an episode that we had been paywalled, but that we released for free, that we did with the historian Stuart Schrader, who is a great historian of American policing, that we sent to your feed, that discusses these issues in a global context. And I think that it is important to understand the relationship between ICE and what the United States does abroad. The sort of on the nose thing is that in March 2003, two things happened. One, ICE came into being and Iraq was invaded. And there's a very clear connection between U.S. imperial overreach abroad and the type of violence that we see at home. So I just wanted to point people to that episode. Well, Derek, I think let's jump into the news and let's start with Venezuela and let's start with Rodriguez taking office.
Right. So Delcy Rodriguez, who was serving as vice president under Nicolas Maduro and was left in place, of course, by the Trump administration when it kidnapped Maduro over the weekend, officially took office on Monday. She had been ordered to take charge as interim president by the country's Supreme Court prior to that. So she made it official on Monday. Notably, her rhetoric around assuming office formally took a marked turn after over the weekend being very strident, demanding Maduro's release, criticizing the U.S. for its operations. She has struck a more conciliatory tone over the past few days, talking about, you know, inviting the U.S. government to cooperate with Venezuelan authorities, that type of thing. I don't want to get into, you know, the speculation that there's been about whether or not some people in Maduro's inner circle, whether or not that includes Rodriguez, kind of tossed him out to the U.S. to save their own skin. I don't think it's productive to go around on that question. But there definitely seems to be a tone with her, at least, and there are obviously different elements of the inner circle and different folks in high levels in the Venezuelan government who may feel differently, but around her, at least, there does seem to be a tone of let's try to make the best of this situation at the very least. The U.S. has apparently threatened issued threats to other members of the inner circle, in particular the interior minister, Diosdado Cabello, that he could be next, or these guys could be next, the more hardline figures, if they make trouble for Rodriguez or for this new arrangement, I guess, which is government by proxy. It seems like we can get more into this when we talk about the plans that the U.S. has for Venezuelan oil, but it really does seem to be basically not a direct takeover, but this new administration, whatever you want to call it, will be doing what the U.S. Wants, or else there will be further action like what we saw over the weekend.
Let's talk about the Maduro indictment. What are the details that have come out with that?
Yeah, there's some peculiar things here. Spencer Ackerman recounted a number of them in one of his newsletters this week. But if you actually look at the indictment, you'll note a couple of curious things, which is that U.S. prosecutors are of all the things they're charging Maduro with, including, I think, possession of machine guns, which is a fascinating thing to charge a head of state with. They are not charging him with trafficking fentanyl, despite the fact that this has been one of their main points of contention with Maduro, that he's been flooding the United States with fentanyl. That's been bullshit, of course, all along. But they're not even really talking about it anymore, at least not in, in terms of these legal charges. The other thing that was noted by the New York Times first, and then Spencer also included in his newsletter, is that they've dropped their references to the Cartel de los Soles, which was supposedly being run by Maduro. The Cartel de los Soles has been well established as a fictional entity. It does not exist, but the U.S. has been accusing Maduro of running it for a year now, and this is justified not only his abduction and removal to New York to stand trial, rendition. It's also been used to justify the repeated strikes on boats in Venezuelan waters, killed over 100 people at this point. It was always horseshit, and now the U.S. government is sort of tacitly admitting that by not including it in its indictment. There is a mention, and this is another absurd aspect of this, there is a mention of a cocaine trafficking incident that they're trying to tie Maduro to, or cocaine trafficking program, I guess, not really an incident, but that they identified between 2003 and 2011. Nicolas Maduro didn't become president of Venezuela until 2013. So what is really going on here is that this was the cocaine trafficking operation that was run by Tony Hernandez. Tony Hernandez was the brother of former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was also implicated in that cocaine trafficking ring, arrested, convicted in the U.S., and Trump just pardoned him a couple of months ago. So the whole thing is just a farce. Really, and it's going to be interesting to see how the trial goes, because it really doesn't look like they've got much to go on here once you peel away all of the fictions and the absurdities, the internal contradictions in the case that they're trying to make.
What about Trump's plan for Venezuelan oil? He said several things. What does it appear to be, at least at this very early stage?
Yeah, so I mean, this is where we get into the basically total control of Venezuela. There have been multiple reports here. ABC News reported on Tuesday that the administration had presented Rodriguez with a list of requirements, basically before Venezuela will be allowed to sell any oil again. And those requirements include kicking out China, Russia, Iran, and Cuba, and severing economic ties with them. As well as agreeing to partner exclusively with the U.S. on oil production and favoring America when selling its oil. That coincides with declarations that have come out of the U.S. Energy Department and from Trump via social media that basically seem to indicate that the U.S. expects to be managing Venezuelan oil sales indefinitely. There is a first cut or tranche of oil that is apparently already, I think, there are already tankers leaving Venezuela that is supposed to come to the U.S. of between 30 and 50 million barrels of this Venezuelan oil. The U.S. will take ownership of it, and then take responsibility for selling it with the proceeds to go who knows where at this point. All we know is it's going to be to the benefit of U.S. citizens and Venezuelans. If you believe that, I don't know what to say. But beyond that initial 50 million barrel bequeathment, the plan is to basically manage these transactions indefinitely, to park the proceeds in U.S. banks before, I guess, deigning to give any of it to Venezuela. There's restrictions. I mean, it's again, some of this stuff comes just from Trump kind of spewing things out on social media, but he's claimed that Venezuela will be limited to buying U.S. made products with their oil revenue, whatever portion of the oil revenue they're actually allowed to have. So a lot of very intense restrictions that sound like they're on the table, at least. The other aspect of this that, again, adds to the absurdity of the situation is that Trump has talked about rebuilding Venezuela's oil capacity by bringing U.S. Oil companies, energy companies, into the market to invest what would have to be tens of billions of dollars in rebuilding Venezuela's oil facilities, its infrastructure. Economically, this makes no sense, especially at the current price of oil, which is around $60 per barrel. Trump is supposedly hoping to use Venezuelan oil to bring that price down to around $50 per barrel, at least in the U.S. for U.S. consumers. That would make it even less economically feasible for these companies to go and invest tens of billions of dollars in the Venezuelan oil industry. It's also the case that Venezuela's, the type of oil that comes out of Venezuela, is heavy crude that has to be refined quite a bit before it is usable, is even less economically, you know, kind of viable. Going to draw even less investment than you might see in like Libya or places where there's a lighter crude that's more easily brought to market. So what Trump is already talking about is subsidizing oil companies to go into Venezuela and rebuild the country's oil infrastructure, basically just a massive transfer of U.S. taxpayer money to major oil firms, which I'm sure they would be thrilled with, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for anybody else outside of that community. So that's basically where we stand. It's an oil grab, but the perversity of it is that the oil companies don't really want to be there, probably, and so we're going to pay them to go in and take the oil. So it's going to work out great, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. We will keep everyone, of course, updated on this very important subject. Derek, let's move on to Yemen, where the Saudis have rolled back the Southern Transitional Council's gains, and also the leader has fled to the UAE.
Right. So over the holiday, what was the holiday break here in the U.S. And really around the new year, the Saudi-led coalition backing the internationally recognized Yemeni government, which is called the Homeland Shield Coalition, began a military operation in two eastern Yemeni provinces that the Southern Transitional Council, we've talked about on the program, had seized, Hadramut and Mahra. It was able to take both of those provinces in fairly short order, was able to take both of those provinces back from the SDC and began advancing on Aden, the southern port city that has served as the de facto capital of that region, and where the leader of the Southern Transitional Council, Idarus Zubeidi, had sort of set up shop as he was preparing for who knows, really, to take over ministries. And at one point, the SDC did issue an announcement that it was beginning a two-year transition process to an independence referendum for southern Yemen, or as it's been calling it, southern Arabia. So within a couple of days around the new year, that a lot of that seemed to have been beaten back. The Saudis at that point, after having retaken Hadramut and Mahra, especially the city of Mukalla, which is a port city, it's the capital of Hadramut province, very important port city in the east, especially for oil. After having retaken that portion of the country, they then invited Zubeidi and other Southern Transitional Council leaders to Riyadh for negotiations on trying to reach an accord, an accommodation for southern Yemen moving forward. Zubeidi was supposed to board a flight to Riyadh for those negotiations late Tuesday and just didn't get on the flight, disappeared. After about a day of speculation as to where he might have been, the Saudis, the coalition, the Homeland Shield Coalition, which effectively is the Saudi government, announced that it had information that Zubeidi had boarded some kind of vessel that took him from Aden to the port of Berbera, which is in Somaliland. We'll be talking about Somaliland a bit later, the quasi-independent portion of Somalia. From there, he and his UAE backers, supporters, enablers, who helped get him out of Yemen in the first place, boarded a flight to Mogadishu and then from Mogadishu to Abu Dhabi, which is where he supposedly is right now in hiding. He has been charged by the internationally recognized Yemeni government. And I have to keep saying that because that is literally its name, the internationally recognized government, or IRG. He's been charged by that government with treason. So he is basically a fugitive from the law at this point. The Saudis, who did welcome other Southern Transitional Council leadership to Riyadh, appear to be arranging a transition of leadership from him to other members of the council, presumably with the condition that they drop this talk of secession and with the Saudis taking over kind of patronage of the group from the UAE, which of course, this is all kind of foregrounding an increase that's been happening for a couple of years now in tensions between the Saudis and the Emiratis, not just in Yemen, but in many other places. So that's where things stand. Zubaydah is now, fugitive from justice in Abu Dhabi. The Saudis are taking apart the STC and trying to refashion it in a less provocative image. And the Yemeni government seems to be back in control. The nominal Yemeni government seems to be back in control of the south, including the presidential palace in Aden and other parts of that city. That's kind of where things are.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Israel-Palestine. And let's start with Israel banning certain aid groups.
Yes, the Israeli government has proscribed 37 humanitarian organizations, most prominently Doctors Without Borders, over failing to provide Israeli authorities with lists of their Palestinian employees. The rationale for not providing Israel with a list of one's Palestinian employees is that the Israeli military has a habit of killing Palestinian employees of international aid organizations. They killed at least 579 of them, according to the United Nations, since the start of the conflict in Gaza, the October 7th attacks in 2023. So you can understand why some of these organizations would not want to provide the Israeli government with lists, but the Israelis say that they can't vet the local employees, so they can't be sure if any of these organizations are working with members of Hamas or other armed groups. So that's why they're shutting their operations down in Israel. They can't shut down these groups' operations in Gaza, but they can shut their operations down in Israel, which would effectively makes it impossible for them to work in Gaza. Now, the Israelis are defending themselves against charges that this is yet another restriction on desperately needed humanitarian aid by arguing that the groups that they've banned or proscribed only account for about 1% of all the aid entering Gaza. First of all, you know, Israeli figures regarding aid getting into Gaza are notoriously unreliable at this point. But the second consideration there is that many of these groups don't bring aid in so much as they operate within the territory to provide services, like Doctors Without Borders, which manages a lot of the healthcare or medical care in Gaza. So that's not really a representative statistic to throw out there in terms of assessing the impact of this ban. But there's nothing to roll. Nothing's going to roll this back at this point. I mean, outside of pressure from the United States, and that doesn't seem to be forthcoming.
Let's talk about the settlement in the West Bank as Trump moves himself forward on the ceasefire.
Right. The Israeli government issued a tender for the proposed E1 settlement. We've talked about this in the past. That is the first step towards soliciting bids from developers to build an initial tranche of about 3,400 housing units. E1 is a very controversial, very significant settlement that's situated just east of East Jerusalem. It lies between East Jerusalem and the Maale Adumim settlement, and its construction will bisect the West Bank once and for all, north to south, preventing moving forward, unless these things are dismantled, the formation of a territorially contiguous Palestinian state. And this is not just, kind of hair on fire rhetoric. This is something that Israeli officials talk about as a reason to build this settlement because they want to foreclose on the possibility of Palestinian statehood. So this development, we've talked about E1 in the past and Bezalel Smotrich sort of moving that project forward last year. But this is, a step toward making that a concrete thing. As far as Trump and the peace process is concerned, Barak Ravid reported earlier this week that Trump is planning to unveil his Board of Peace next week. That is supposed to roll out the second phase of the Gaza ceasefire. The first phase is still not really been fulfilled. There are a number of lingering issues, including the return of the remains of the last Gaza captive, including the formation of the International Stabilization Force that's supposed to be in Gaza. Aid, the Israelis have still not, fulfilled their obligations as far as aid or reopening the Rafah border crossing. All of these things are still up in the air. Apparently Trump got some pushback to the idea of just kind of trying to will the second phase into existence in this way from Benjamin Netanyahu, who did not want to move forward, especially without the return of the body of the last captive. But he convinced Netanyahu during a meeting, I believe in Miami last week, to drop those objections and go forward. The Board of Peace is supposed to be kind of sit at the top of the hierarchy in Gaza for whatever reconstruction goes on here. It's supposed to consist of around 15 world leaders. It'll be chaired by Trump. The identities, the size of the board and the identities of the other leaders is still up in the air because the administration is apparently still, sending out invitations like we would, to leaders they would like to participate. So nothing has been determined. It's unclear how many of the invited leaders will participate. But again, this is supposed to kind of kick off the second phase of the deal, the ceasefire deal, even though the first phase still, hasn't been concluded.
In any other news week, this story would have gotten a lot more play than it has. But let's talk about these protests in Iran.
Right. There have been protests that started about 10 days ago at this point. Don't check my math on that. But in multiple cities around the country, they are similar to protests we've seen in recent years that often do seem to break out around kind of the end of the year and then have to do with economic grievances. The Iranian economy is, struggling under sanctions. The rial has seen its value crash completely in recent years, but it crashed further after the United Nations reimposed sanctions, its old nuclear sanctions, on Iran back in September at the behest of the governments of Germany, France, and the UK. The rial hit, I think, 1.3 million per dollar. Not long after that, and it's only gone down since then. I think it's close to 1.5 million to the dollar at this point. Maybe lower than that by by this point. The last I saw was 1.48, something like that. So it's crashed, even further than you could imagine, I guess, and that has driven people out into the streets with grievances. And as generally happens, these things start out with protests over economic conditions. They quickly become protests against the Iranian government more broadly. It's always difficult to assess how widespread they are. They're certainly geographically widespread. There have been reports from, as I said, multiple cities all over the country, but the size of them, the extent of them, the extent to which they've penetrated, multiple sectors of Iranian society is unclear. I don't think that at this point there's much to mark them out as a genuine threat to topple the Iranian government. But that said, the state of the rial, the state of the Iranian economy is not something that can be remedied. There's very little that the Iranian government can do to actually address the grievances that these people have. And so you may see things continue to spiral. The impetus, in the absence of a way to actually address those grievances, the impetus for the government is going to be to crack down We've already seen, I think, somewhere between the two claims I've seen, 36 and 45 deaths. Not all of those are protesters. There's at least a couple of Iranian security forces killed in this, but a number of people killed in these protests already. If the violence continues to increase, that's only going to become, going to fuel more grievances for the protesters, and things can continue to spiral. There was a protest, a major protest apparently, that started to break out on Thursday evening in Tehran. And the interesting thing about this is it came after a call from Reza Pahlavi, the son of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, the last ruler of Iran before the Iranian Revolution in 1979. It's unclear how big this protest was, because, not coincidentally, I would assume, internet and phone service in Iran, like across the country, cut out as this protest was materializing. But what's interesting about that is this is, to this point, been a fairly decentralized, leaderless kind of protest movement. And if Reza Pahlavi is able to claim some leadership or some ability to turn large numbers of people out into the streets on his behalf, that could change the nature of the protests and the threat, or at least the perceived threat to the Iranian government. So it remains to be seen. As I said, this stuff was happening on Thursday. We're recording on Thursday, so hard to assess, and especially with the communications blackout. But that could prove to be a notable development.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's MOOD.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to mood.com, that's MOOD.com, to get started.
Let's talk about a subject that has gotten, as far as I can tell, almost no coverage in the Western media, and that is the Thai-Cambodia ceasefire holding despite this recent mortar attack. So, Derek, tell us what happened.
Right. The two governments signed a new ceasefire on December 27th. People may recall that they fought a series of border skirmishes back in July, and Donald Trump famously, parachuted in and claimed that he had resolved the problem. They signed a ceasefire deal. They signed a bigger ceasefire deal at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit later in the year. Everything kind of fell apart in December. Starting on December 8th, they began fighting again. But they signed a new ceasefire pact on December 27th, notably without, I think, much U.S. involvement. The Chinese government was involved here. The Malaysian government, I believe, was also involved. The Malaysian government had been involved in negotiating the first ceasefire. As you said, Danny, there's been a little bit of a rocky patch this week. There was a Cambodian mortar attack that wounded a Thai soldier on Tuesday morning. But that turns out, or at least according to the Cambodians, turns out to have been an accident. There was some sort of operational error that caused the mortar to fire. They were not intending to attack the Thai military. The Thai government has taken this explanation at face value, so there's been no escalation since then. So it does seem to be holding. They've also advanced further under this ceasefire than they had under the previous one. For example, there's a group of 18 Cambodian soldiers and the Thai government had been holding since the end of that initial conflict in July that they had been refusing to release back to Cambodia. This was a source of considerable tension. They have now released those soldiers under the second ceasefire. So in that sense, and in the sense that there seems to be some better monitoring of potential violations along the border, there's been a little more, a little more progress on that front. So that things seem to be on a bit more stable footing under this second ceasefire than they were under the first one.
Let's talk about these U.S. airstrikes on Nigeria that are currently in the process of being questioned.
Yeah, on Christmas Day, Donald Trump made good on his threat to attack Nigeria, although he did it apparently in coordination with the Nigerian government, to strike supposedly Islamic State sites in Sokoto State, which is in northwestern Nigeria. There have been a lot of questions, as you say, about this strike. It supposedly hit a couple of camps of the militant group known as the Lakarawa, which is thought to be Islamic State affiliated, but is also very kind of still very, very little is known about this group. It's fairly new. A lot of the questions have had to do with, like, if you were going to bomb jihadists in Nigeria, why would you not bomb like Boko Haram or Islamic State West Africa province in the northeastern part of the country, which is where this problem is the most most significant? Or if you were going to step in to stop this alleged Christian genocide, the kind of fictitious Christian genocide that got Trump so motivated to threaten to attack Nigeria in the first place. Why would you bomb Sokoto, which is in the far northwest? It's nowhere near the areas where Christian communities are most under threat or are most in conflict with their Muslim neighbors, which tends to be along the middle part of Nigeria. Questions about the targeting choice, questions about what they actually hit. There are sketchy reports of dozens of Lakarawa fighters being killed, but information is hard to come by. And again, this group is not well known. I mean, it's not well organized. Its allegiances, it's thought to be affiliated with Islamic State, but that's not definite. And maybe it may not all be one thing. Like, there may be elements of the group that are affiliated with Islamic State, or elements that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, or that have no affiliation. You know, it's not terribly easy to distinguish this group from just the banditry that is a major problem in the northwestern part of Nigeria. So yeah, a lot of questions about why this target or what was supposed to have been gained here. I guess it did appease whatever constituency Trump was hoping to appease by attacking jihadists in Nigeria. He'd been threatening to do so for some time, as we know.
Let's move on to this interesting story where Israel has recognized Somaliland. So, Derek, do you want to just let people know what Somaliland is? This is kind of a complex international issue.
Yeah, Somaliland is sort of the northern part of Somalia. If you look at Somalia, it's shaped kind of like a seven. It's the northern part of that, and it kind of goes around the Horn of Africa, but Somaliland is that northern chunk. It's British Somaliland, basically. When Somalia was created, it was a merging of colonies that had belonged to, you know, Britain and Italy, I think, were the two main ones. And British Somaliland is this territory kind of at the Horn of Africa or along the Red Sea. And it's been declared independence in the early 1990s. So it's been operating as a basically independent state without any recognition for over 30 years at this point. On December 26th, the Israeli government became the first government in the world to recognize Somaliland as an independent state. This immediately sent up red flags, and that's because of Gaza. But there are a few kind of strategic aims that the Israelis can get out of recognizing Somaliland. There's rumors that Somaliland agreed to host an Israeli military base, certainly having a new ally in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in the Red Sea area, is significant for the Israelis, who have seen their support, diplomatic presence and support across Africa crater over the last couple of years. But the big thing is that there's been speculation, there've been reporting for months now that the Israelis have been negotiating with the Somaliland government about a trade whereby the Israelis would recognize Somaliland's independence and the Somaliland government would facilitate the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, would take in Palestinians who, you know, quote unquote, voluntarily leave Gaza. Somaliland officials have denied consistently that they want anything to do with that. They've also denied any plans to host an Israeli military base. But, you know, whether you believe that or not, I guess, depends on your perspective. It very much remains to be seen. The Israeli foreign minister, Gideon Saar, visited Somaliland on Tuesday. This was the first kind of official diplomatic trip by senior Israeli officials since the recognition. This drew a lot of criticism from the Somali government, which called it basically unacceptable interference in Somali internal Somali affairs. The repercussions of this for the region and whether there are going to be other countries that follow suit, all of this has yet to kind of play out. Somalia has a number of regional challenges in terms of like regional autonomous governments that are more or less willing to kind of follow Mogadishu's lead. And with Somaliland gaining, you know, some recognition of independence, we'll see how much, but that could spur other movements to kind of peel away from Mogadishu, which of course will have repercussions for the fight against al-Shabaab and Islamic State's rather meager presence in that country. But there are all sorts of things to watch in that regard. There is a question, of course, whether the United States is going to follow suit. Donald Trump has talked about potentially recognizing Somaliland. This is something he's talked about for a while, to the extent that he actually understands what Somaliland is or any of this. We also know from his comments about Somali Americans, how he feels about Somalia in general, and that could make him more willing to recognize Somaliland. There was an incident this week where the U.S. State Department announced that it is suspending humanitarian aid to Somalia after it claims that the Somali government looted effectively a World Food Program warehouse that the U.S. had been funding in Mogadishu and had taken food out of there. The Somali government is denying any of that. It's unconfirmed. The accusation is unconfirmed as far as I know. It's not even clear how much aid the U.S. is still providing to Somalia after all of the U.S. aid cuts that Trump and Doge enacted earlier this year. Nevertheless, the timing of it is interesting. It looks like it could be the pretext for taking some sort of diplomatic action regarding Somaliland. But again, that's speculation. Only time will tell, is the case for everything.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Ukraine, and let's talk about this Ukrainian coalition making progress on security guarantees vis-a-vis Russia.
All right. The Coalition of the Willing met in Paris on Tuesday, according to several outlets, including the AP, made progress toward the provision of security guarantees to Ukraine in the event that a peace deal is struck with Russia. These guarantees would include weapons, training, logistical support. They're intended to be robust enough to deter a future Russian invasion. There's even talk, and Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, said this, that he and Emmanuel Macron, the President of France, had agreed to establish what he called military hubs across Ukraine that would, store weapons and equipment. Might involve the deployment of French and UK soldiers in some support capacity. They wouldn't be, out close to the frozen front line or the new border or whatever you want to call it. But they would be in Ukraine where, the Russian government has repeatedly said any foreign soldiers in Ukraine would be considered legitimate targets. The U.S. is apparently on board with these commitments. What role the U.S. would take in terms of enabling or supporting those commitments is not entirely clear. And of course, nothing has really been finalized here because anything that's discussed in the Coalition of the Willing would have to at least be acceptable enough to the Russian government to be included in a peace deal. And so far, the Russian government doesn't show all that much interest in being flexible on this. It's still very much up in the air.
So, Derek, there's been a lot of talk about seizing Greenland recently. And apparently, for some reason, the nations of Europe are concerned with U.S. claims that they want to purchase Greenland, as last that I've heard. So tell us about those.
Right. The Venezuela operation really kicked this up. I mean, there was already concern because Trump, over the Christmas break, named Jeff Landry, the governor of Louisiana, as his new special envoy for Greenland, with the sole task of, like, you know, figuring out some way for the U.S. to annex Greenland, like it or not, I guess. So tensions were already high. And then the Venezuela operation, you know, not that there's an analog that you could imagine happening in Greenland, but it does speak to a willingness to just run roughshod over the Western Hemisphere that was, I think, disconcerting under the circumstances. So there's been a lot of talk about the U.S. just militarily going in and taking Greenland over. The White House hasn't ruled that out, notably, but has tried over the past couple of days to redirect the discussion into possibly buying Greenland, I guess buying it from Denmark, which would be similar to, you know, past land purchases that the U.S. has made. Although I would think in 2026, we're a little more reticent to just buy and sell land that people are living on than we were in like 1803. Nevertheless, that's where things are at this point. There was a report in Reuters on Thursday that the Trump administration is considering direct cash payments to Greenlanders as part of this project to convince them to you know, kind of become part of the U.S. or to allow their country to become part of the U.S. It's unclear what the purchase price would look like if the U.S. were to offer Denmark money to buy Greenland. The Danish government has refused to countenance the idea even of selling Greenland. And, you know, again, you would think that Greenland itself would have something to say about this, or you would hope at least that Greenland would have something to say about it. The other thing that I saw in the Reuters piece, which I haven't seen much discussion publicly from anybody in the Trump administration, is the idea of Greenland becoming independent of Denmark and then joining a compact of free association, which is the types of agreements that the U.S. has with countries in the Pacific, like Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Palau, that bind those countries to the U.S. in a way that's short of outright, you know, territorial acquisition, but you know, could be enough to satisfy whatever mineral ambitions or security demands that Donald Trump seems that he needs to fulfill in Greenland. As you say, there's been a lot of consternation in Europe about this. There is no reason to believe that even if the U.S. went in militarily and took over Greenland, that it would draw anything more than like a sharply worded memo from Brussels or from the Danish government. Nothing that they have done or said has indicated anything more than kind of desperate pleading with the U.S. to please stop talking about this. Why can't you see that we're all friends here? But there's been no kind of you know, line in the sand or kind of putting the foot down proverbially against something like this. And I think the response to the Maduro, as we talked about with Greg Grandin, like the European response to the Maduro operation speaks to just the level of spinelessness that these people have at this point. I don't think they would be able to muster up much more for Greenland than they've been able to muster up for anything else.
And of course, we stand with Bjork and the people of Greenland against all colonial overlords. Bjork, if you are listening, you have an open invitation to the podcast. We'd love to have you on.
Absolutely.
Let's conclude. Let's conclude with Trump pushing for a $1.5 trillion military budget, which would be both relatively and absolutely, I believe, as far as I know, the largest military budget in American history.
And it would be totally batshit, especially because, like, this has already been voted on. Like Congress already approved the 2026 National Defense Authorization Act at around $1 trillion to suddenly inject another $500 billion into the military budget. It's not even clear what they would do with it. I'm sure they'd find a good home for the money fairly quickly if it was actually approved. But, you know, just flooding the Pentagon with all this extra cash because you suddenly got a hard on for the U.S. military now that they've pulled off this super cool operation to take out the bad guys in Caracas is just really, even for Trump standards, just really beyond the pale, batshit. So yeah, he's talking about it. He's also talking about cracking down on defense contractors, you know, in the same series of unhinged social media posts. And this is sort of like, you know, a stop clock is right twice a day. He talked about ending dividends and stock buybacks at these major defense companies. Executive pay packages need to be reduced because the companies are producing, they're taking too long to supply the military and they're producing shoddy products. So, you know, all of these complaints, which do have merit, as we've talked about on this show and as other, you know, others have covered at length, coming in the service of like, ballooning the U.S. military budget up to $1.5 trillion and beyond, as it would almost certainly continue to increase in years, the years to come, rather than trying to get some sanity into the U.S. military budget and reduce it, I think, you know, is pretty wrongheaded. Yeah, you know, what are you going to do at this point? He's feeling his oats, I guess, now that the Maduro thing, he pulled off this Maduro thing.
And let's end with Trump removing the United States from my understanding, dozens of UN groups.
He signed an order on Wednesday withdrawing the U.S. from 31 United Nations institutions and 35 other international organizations. I don't have the full list, but the big ones have to do with climate. The big ones, as far as I can tell and seem, have to do with climate. So Trump withdrew the U.S. from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the grandfather UN treaty that governs all the climate agreements. So you hear about the Paris Agreement or any of these other things. It all comes under this framework convention. Trump had already pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement again, which he did in his first term. But withdrawing from the framework convention will make it much harder for a future administration to kind of come back into these things, assuming that you know we elect an administration that actually wants to at least get back to pretending to care about climate change. He also pulled the U.S. out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the U.N.'s monitoring agency. Getting out of these woke climate things appears to have been his main agenda, but there's a lot of other, as you said, dozens of other organizations that he pulled out of as well.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you haven't yet, check out our episode with the great Greg Grandin on Venezuela, putting that in a larger historical context. Check out our episode with Stuart Schrader, and consider subscribing to the show. It takes a lot of work, and we really appreciate when people are able to support us. We've got, I think, an interesting and important and also fun episode coming up on Sunday with Jay Kang and Sam Biddle about prediction markets. So if you've been hearing about prediction markets, like I think it's Kalshi and Poly Market, right, Derek?
Poly Market.
Poly Markets. Check out that episode. As always, thank you everyone for listening and keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's Mood.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to mood.com. That's mood.com to get started.
Whether you're walking barefoot in the snow, escaping for a walk on your lunch break, or trekking halfway across the world for a lush view, it feels good when we unplug and connect to our simpler side. If only our everyday nutrition were that simple. It's time to simplify your wellness routine with Ka'Chava. Getting the nutrition we need from that graveyard of supplements in our cupboards is often overcomplicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, keep it simple with just 2 scoops that have the highest quality ingredients. Simplify your nutrition at Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get $20 off an order of 2 bags or more now through January 31st. That's Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.